The essence of Urah is to bring children home to their Torah heritage. In other words, to achieve the ultimate goals of Kiruv. And because Kiruv is the focus of Urah, I've decided tonight to speak on Kiruv concepts, to talk about how people should get involved in Kiruv, how Kiruv is done in the most proper way. But I would like to begin by telling you a very interesting story about two friends of mine. Both of these fellows are twins. One, his name is Simcha Barnett. The other is Michal Barnett. But when this story takes place, Simcha was Steve and Michal was Mitch. They were both into sports. They did everything together. They grew up in Wantagh in Long Island, and wherever they went, they always enjoyed each other's company, playing ball, having a job, doing everything together. Both of them enjoyed biking, and they decided that they were going to take a bike tour, and they decided to go to New Zealand. Now, if you know the map of New Zealand, actually there's a North Island and a South Island, and it's separated by what's called the Cook Strait, a whole body of water. And so they took a plane, obviously, to New Zealand, and they came there, and they were biking through the North Island. And then Steve, who told me the story, tells me that they had to get on a boat, a ferry boat, that took them over Cook Strait, and then they get onto the second part of the trip, which is in the South Island. Now, right there, near the beginning of the trip in the South Island, there was a very, very steep mountain. It was like an 8-mile climb. And all the young men and the women that were on this bike tour, it was very, very difficult to pedal. It was almost like going straight up. And Steve told me that as this bike tour was getting up on the mountain, he realized that some of the fellows ahead of him, everybody was carrying a backpack. And you carry things that you're going to need overnight. You carry sometimes a book, sometimes a wrench, sometimes other things that you're going to need on the trip because everybody is traveling with their own things. And he noticed that as they were going higher and higher and it was getting more difficult to pedal, that the fellows in front of him, one guy would reach back, take out a heavy book and just throw it off. And another guy would take out an extra wrench that they needed and figured, listen, I'll use somebody else's wrench. And what they were trying to do was to get to the top of the mountain, but making their load lighter. And Steve told me that many, many years later, when he became a Baal Tshuva, he realized that that trip on the mountain was really of great significance. Because he said if he wanted to get to the top of the mountain, he would have to get rid of some of the baggage that he was carrying. In other words, if he wanted to get to the top of the spiritual mountain in life, which he did, when he became a Baal Tshuva together with his brother, he knew that he would have to throw off some of that baggage that he was carrying. I was so moved by this thought that if somebody wants to reach the top of the spiritual mountain, they've got to get rid of some of the baggage that they've been carrying. I mentioned it to my son Avram. A couple hours later, this was on Yontif when Simcha told me the story. And my son Avram said to me, "What do you mean, Todd? That's a pasuk." And I said, "What pasuk are you talking about?" And he said so correctly, the pasuk that David HaMelech writes in Tillim, "Mi yale b'har Hashem, o mi yakum b'mkoyim kachoy?" Who is the one who can ascend, who can go up to that mountain of Hashem, the mountain of God? O mi yakum b'mkoyim kachoy? Who can remain in that holy place? Nechi kapayim, the one who has clean hands, he's gotten rid of all that extra baggage. I couldn't get over that. That's exactly the story that Simcha Barnett was telling me. You're getting up to the top of the mountain, but you got to get rid of that baggage. So sure enough, I started looking in the Mefarshim, in the commentaries on that pasuk, and one of the commentaries says something incredible. He says, David HaMelech is telling us that if you want to get to the top of the spiritual mountain, you got to get rid of that load. The word load in Hebrew is masa, mem, shin, aleph. Or Sin Aleph, Masa. And he says, Masa stands for Momoin, Simlois, and Oichel. Money, clothes, and food. A person cannot be so obsessed by money, so obsessed by food, so obsessed by the clothes that he wears. Those cannot be the priorities. And if a person wants to reach the top of that spiritual mountain, he's got to get rid of that Masa, that load. And you know, something occurred to me. When you take a look at the Pasuk, David HaMelech is telling us, it's not only enough, mi yale b'har Hashem, who is going to go up on the mountain of Hashem, but umi yakum, who's going to be able to stand there, who's going to be able to remain there. And the idea is that sometimes a person is inspired, or we inspire somebody to become a Baal Tshuva. But the point is that the person, you have to inspire him in such a way that he's going to remain standing on that high level. It's not enough just to inspire somebody so that they will do something good, or they will observe a Shabbos and they will observe a Yontif. You want much more than that. You have to follow up with them. You have to remain with them. You have to give them that type of inspiration that they are going to remain on that very, very high level. All of us remember in the Torah one of the most dramatic moments of Jewish history. And that moment is when Yosef is confronting the brothers, Yehuda, and all the other brothers that came to buy food in Mitzrayim. And Yosef says to them, listen, remember, we had a deal. Anybody who had that geviah, that cup, in their knapsack, they're going to have to remain as my slave. The rest of you can go back to your father. And of course, Yehuda was terrified. He promised that he is going to bring back Binyamin. And the knapsack was found in and the becher was found in Binyamin's knapsack. So Yehuda says to Yosef, "Ki eich ele el avi, how am I going to go up to my father? V'hanar einenu iti, and the child is not with me." In other words, he made a promise. He's going to be responsible for Binyamin. He says, I cannot go back to my father Yaakov without bringing the child Binyamin. And you know, there are many Hasidic Rebbes who have said very, very interesting things on this pasuk, on this phrase. One of them said, Ki eich ele el avi, how am I going to go to my father in heaven? All of us, none of us are going to live forever. There's going to come a time we go up to Shemayim after 120. Eich ele el avi. How are we going to go to our Father in heaven? Vahanar. And our children are not with us. The children have not remained as religious as we wanted them to. They didn't live the type of lives that we were expecting them to live. What are we going to answer for that? Ki eich ele el avi. Vahanar einenu iti. And then there are those who say, Ki eich el elavi, how am I going to go to my father in heaven, Vanar, and my youth is not with me. I wasted all those years of youth. What are you going to answer for that question? Youth is a time of vitality. Youth is a time of accomplishment. And what is a person going to say? Eich el elavi, how's he going to go to his father in heaven, Vahanar einenu iti, and his youth is not with him. And others say, Vahanar is referring to vibrancy. We know the Pasuk tells us in Shema Yislam and Gimel Yud Aleph, Umashur so Yeshua Benun Nar Lo Yomash Mitoicha Oyel. The attendant of Moshe Rabbeinu was Yeshua, the Nar, the young man, Lo Yomash Mitoicha Oyel. He didn't move from the tent of Moshe. He was always there. And the question Rashi and others ask, Ibn Ezra actually says, Yeshua was 56 years old at that time. So what does it mean that he's called a Nar? A Nar, we usually mean a younger person. But the answer is no. It's referring to the idea of vibrancy. A person is not supposed to be burned out. Yeshua was vibrant, even though that he was 56. He was the nar. He was the vibrant, the passionate, excited person who was always there together with Moshe Rabbeinu. And I think, based on those three pshatim, that we can add something else. We have to ask ourselves this question, especially in America. Ki eich ele el avi. How are we going to go to our Father in heaven after 120 years? Vahanar einenu iti. And the youth of Klal Yisrael is not with us. There are hundreds and thousands of children out there that know nothing about Yiddishkeit. What are we doing? What have you done? What has anybody done? There are people that are involved in Kirov, and they will be able to answer that question. But what about us? Are we doing anything? Do we feel a responsibility to the youth of Klal Yisrael? Could you imagine? I'll tell you some statistics. It's absolutely incredible. There are 13.3 million Jews in the world. 13.3 million Jews in the world. Only 1.8 million are religious. That means 4 out of 5 Jews are not religious. Imagine that you lived on a block and on the corner there was a man who had five sons, and four out of the five sons went off to Derech, knew nothing about Yiddishkeit, didn't care anything about Hashem or the Torah or about anything that has to do with Yiddishkeit. Wouldn't you feel bad for that person? You'd cry for that person. Four out of five children are off to Derech. Our Father in heaven wants us to do something about it. He needs our help. He wants our help. That's what Kirov is all about. For those four out of five Jews that know nothing about Yiddishkeit. That's the achrayus that each and every one of us have. And I believe if that's the case, there are two types of Kirov that we have to speak about. I think there's two types of Kirov. One type of Kirov is passive. The other type is active. Passive means when you do certain things, you're not doing it necessarily for the sake of Kirov, but you're doing it in such a way that it will inspire other people. That's passive. And I'll give you an example. In the neighborhood where I live, there's a fellow, his name is Nosson Meltzer, Rabbi Nosson Meltzer, a wonderful, wonderful person. A number of years ago, I get a call from a fellow in Westchester, not religious, and many of you know that I'm a Moyel, and he calls me up, this irreligious fellow, and he says to me, you know, I just had a baby, and I would like to have you do the bris. And I said, well, when was the baby born? He says, on a Wednesday morning. And I tell him, well, we got to do it the next Wednesday. You count the first day that the baby was born as day one, Wednesday, Thursday, and you go on. The eighth day would be next Wednesday. He says, Rabbi, I can't do it Wednesday. I got to do it on Sunday. I said, what do you mean you can't? You can't do it on Sunday. You have to do it on the eighth day. He says, Rabbi, but, you know, I want all my people to come. I got to go to work. I said, listen, I'll tell you what we can do. You can do it right before sunset. See, really, you're supposed to do a bris in the morning to show your enthusiasm for the mitzvah. But you can do technically a bris until sunset. So I said, why don't you do it, you know, until sunset? Right before sunset, like a half hour, so you can get your work day in. Your friends and relatives will be able to get a work day in, and we'll do it right before sunset. So he's giving me a hard time. He really doesn't want to do it. Well, what am I supposed to do? So how am I going to force his hand? So we start talking about the bris, when to plan it, but then we get into a discussion about what he should prepare for the bris. And I tell him the ointment, the gauze pads, peroxide, and everything else like that. And then, right near the end of the conversation, I say to him, you know, you live up in Westchester. How'd you get my name? He says, well, in your neighborhood, there's a fellow by the name of Nosson Meltzer. He's my cousin. And he's the one who gave me your name. When I asked him a couple months ago, my wife was expecting, and, you know, we knew we were going to have a boy, so I said to him, you know, Rabbi Meltzer, who do you think you should use as a moel? So he said, Pesach Kroni's in my neighborhood. So that's why I called you. I said, Nosson Meltzer is your cousin? Do you know that he would feel terrible if he knew that his cousin had a boy and didn't have the bris on the proper time? He said, you think it would make a difference to Rabbi Meltzer when I did the bris? I said, of course it would. He said, all right, fine, we'll do it Wednesday. Okay, so we do it Wednesday. Sure enough, I come Wednesday afternoon. This guy's in a wrestler's T-shirt, you know, like, I had to give him a yarmulke. There's no connection, you know, at all to Yiddishkeit. They're all a big bullfan type of guy. But anyway, fine, we do the bris. I was sure Nosson Meltzer would be there. Of course, it's his cousin, right? That's how he got the moel. No, he wasn't there. Okay, we do the bris Wednesday, right before the shkia. Everything is fine. Shabbos afternoon, I come to the local yeshiva in my neighborhood, Yeshiva Shar Torah, and I see Rav Nosson Meltzer. I say, Nosson, mazel tov. He said, for what? I said, Nosson, you're kidding, right? He said, what are you talking about? I said, Nosson, your cousin up in Westchester had a boy. You don't know about that? He said, no, they didn't call me. I said, what are you talking about? Nosson, they called you a few months ago, and you gave him my name. I said, he says, oh, yeah, I forgot about that. But when they had the baby, they didn't call me. I said, Nosson, don't you realize that when you get to Shemayim after 120 years, you're going to have the reward of a baby having had a bris on the eighth day, and Hashem's going to give you the reward, and you won't know what Hashem's talking about. He said, Pesach, I don't know what you're talking about. And I said to him, Nosson, this fellow wanted to do the bris on Sunday. He only did it because I said to him, Nosson Meltzer, who's such a religious, committed Jew, he would feel terrible if the bris is not done on the proper time. And that's why he did it. That's passive Kirov. Passive Kirov means Nosson Meltzer didn't tell anything to this fellow, but because he's such an Erlich HaYid, because he's such a wonderful, committed Jew, he made such an impression on his cousin that his cousin lived up to that standard of doing the bris on time because he had a cousin like Nosson Meltzer. That's called passive Kirov. He didn't go out to be makarov or to influence that person, but because of who you are. And that's really the achrayus. Every single one of us has that responsibility to act in Yiddishkeit with mitzvahs and masim tovim and learning and tefillah in such a way that somebody will say, you know something? That's how I want to be. That's called passive kirov. Here's another example. Incredible thing. You know, in Dallas, in North Dallas, is a very close friend of mine. His name is Aryeh Rodin. Aryeh Rodin is the Rav in the Young Israel of North Dallas, and he told me this remarkable story. He told me a story that a number of years ago, when he first started the shul, he had smicha from the Chofetz Chaim Yeshiva here in Queens, and then he went out to start a shul. He started in his home, like many, many Rabbonim start a shul locally, started in their home, and then hopefully they can build a building. But this was in his house, and he was sitting one afternoon, and he's preparing a talk, an adult education lecture, which he was going to give that evening. And all of a sudden, a guy, there's a knock on the door. He never saw this fellow before. And he says to him, who are you? And he says, my name is Leonard Furman. So he says, Leonard, can I help you? He says, you know, Rabbi, I just got back from Israel, you know? And he's telling him a whole story about how he was inspired. He wants to know more about Yiddishkeit. And they get into a wonderful conversation. And they're talking literally almost for an hour. And Rabbi Rodin made such an impression on this fellow Leonard that Leonard says to him, Rabbi, you know, I never had a discussion like this about religion. I want to send your synagogue $2,000. Rabbi Rodin couldn't believe it. Sure enough, 2-3 weeks later, he gets a check, $3,000. And Leonard starts coming to the shul. Eventually, he becomes Orthodox. And he starts giving a tremendous amount of money to the shul. Not only that, his friends start coming to the shul, and eventually they gave so much money that they were able to build a building, and this building is standing today in Dallas. That's the building of the Young Israel of North Dallas. Talmud Torah, day school, everything. Fine. Unfortunately, Leonard never got married, and when he was 49, he had a massive heart attack and he died. So at his funeral, his mother got up, and she said, I cannot thank Rabbi Rodin enough and the people of this synagogue. You helped bring my son back to his roots. And so every penny that he gave to the shul, I'm going to match it. And she wrote out a check on the spot for $50,000. At the 30-day memorial service at the Shloshim, Rabbi Rodin got up to speak. And he said, you know, I remember the first day that Leonard came to my house. And I said to him after the whole discussion, I said, Leonard, you know, there are a lot of shuls in Dallas. Why'd you come to my house, to my shul? I don't even have a building. Listen to what he said. He said, Rabbi, I just got back from Israel. It's the first time I was in Israel. They took us all over the country. The last day they took us to the wall, to the Kaisel Maravi. He said, I don't know anything about praying. I saw people taking their name and putting it into the wall, so that's what I did. I said, Shema Yisrael, that's the only thing I knew, and I took a piece of paper, put my name on the paper, and put it into the wall. And then when I put it into the wall, I saw standing next to me someone who was so connected, he was praying so hard, I was just standing there watching him with awe. I wished that I could be so connected to God like he was. And you know, the truth is, I wanted to give him money. But I figured, it's not nice. I don't know the guy. I'm going to defile the moment. I'm just going to give him money. So when I came back to Dallas, I went into the local bakery. And I said to the lady behind the counter, you know, I just got back from Israel. And there was a guy that was praying at the wall. He was so connected. He was praying with such intensity. Tell me, I said to the lady behind the counter in the bakery, if that guy came to Dallas, what synagogue would he pray in? So she said, he'd go to Rabbi Rodin's synagogue. That's why I came to you. So Rabbi Rodin said, imagine when that Yerushalmi, when that Yid gets to Shemayim after 120 days, Hashem is going to say to him, Rabbi Yid, you know something? Because of you, a shul was built in Dallas. And the guy's going to say, Hashem, what's Dallas? Dollars, I know. I never heard of Dallas. And of course, Hashem's going to tell him, because of the way you davened, you made such an impression on that person that he came to a synagogue, he gave money, and a whole shul was built. Talmud Torah was there. Children eventually went to yeshivas and Beis Yaakov's, all because of the way you were davening. That's passive kirov. That fellow was davening. Did he think that he was making an impression on the next door and the person who was standing right next to him? He had no idea. But when you do something in such an extraordinary way, that's passive kiruv. And therefore, that's exactly how each and every one has to act. Because people watch what we do, the way we learn, the way we come on time to davening, whether we talk during laning, the way we're honest in business, the way we daven, all these things. When you do a mitzvah, you have to do it in such a way, with such kedusha, with such holiness, and with such intensity, and with such feeling and compassion, that other people will want to do it just like you. So I want to tell you one more story. What does it mean, passive kiruv? Imagine if you were involved in this story. There's a gentleman in Eretz Yisrael. His name is Rabbi Yosef Goodfarb. Rabbi Yosef Goodfarb has not missed davening with a minyan in 30 years. No matter where he is in this universe, wherever he travels, he knows what minyan, where the davening mincha, where the davening ma'ariv, and what time. He always figures out, gets the schedule, and he knows how it's going. So it happened about 2 years ago. The guy comes home 3 o'clock in the morning from a wedding, and he realizes, oh my gosh, I didn't daven ma'ariv yet. So if he didn't daven ma'ariv yet, that means that he obviously didn't daven with a minyan. So the question was, where's he going to find a minyan? So if you're in Brooklyn, those of you who live in Flatbush know that if you're in Brooklyn, you go to Landau's. And if you're in Borough Park, you go to Shemesh Shabbos. There's always a minyan, right? 24/7. And if you're in Eretz Yisrael in Bnei Brak, you go to Itzkowitz's on Rehov Rabbi Akiva. What are you going to do in Yerushalayim? So in Yerushalayim, there's a place called Zichron Moshe. So this fellow goes to Zichron Moshe at 3:15 a.m. Listen to this. And he walks around, it's quiet. You know, usually in all the rooms, there's a minyan. No, nobody's there. One guy he finds. He goes over to the guy and he says, excuse me, did you daven ma'ariv yet? He says, no. He says, do you think we're going to have a minyan? He says, what are you kidding? A minyan? It's 3:15 a.m. and an hour and a half, they're going to daven shacharis, vasikin. So, well, how are we going to have a minyan? He says, what do you mean? But I have to have a minyan. I haven't missed a minyan in 30 years. He says, listen, I don't know what you're going to do. Listen to what this guy thinks of. He calls an Israeli cab company, and he says, send me 8 cabs, only Israeli drivers. Imagine that. What an einfall of that person. What an insight. What a creative thought. And the guy, the cab company says, who's got 8 cabs? You know, 3 o'clock in the morning. How many got? 5. Okay, send me 5. He calls another cab company, send me 3 more cabs. Now, 8 cabs come running up to Zichron Moshe 10 minutes later. Everybody's wondering, where's the bar mitzvah? Where's the chasana? What are we doing here? Who are we bringing home? He says, Rabotai, everyone start your meters and come into the synagogue. I'll explain. And he explains to each and every one that he hasn't missed davening with a minyan. He says, I don't care what it cost me. I'm going to pay all of you on the meter so that I should be able to have a minyan and daven ma'ariv with a minyan. And sure enough, listen, some of the guys were religious, so they knew what ma'ariv was. Some of the Israeli secular guys, they didn't know what ma'ariv was, but they knew how to read Hebrew. 25 minutes it took to make sure that everybody daven ma'ariv together. At the end, he goes over to the first guy who came, a frum guy. He says, how much do I owe you? Guy says, listen, sir, I've been davening all my life. Never did I daven in such a holy minyan that a guy is willing to pay 8 guys on the meter. I wouldn't take a penny from you. Then another guy, secular Israeli, he thought for sure he's going to have to pay him. He says, how much do I owe you? He says, sir, I haven't been in a synagogue in 7 years. Tonight you caused me to be in this synagogue? I should pay you, not you should pay me. And of course, not one of those 8 people took a penny from him. Again, that's passive kiruv, because they were all so inspired by this fellow. And anybody, any of us, if we would be there, we would also feel so inspired. And that's what passive kiruv is all about. I want to share with you one more thing, and then we're going to go to the second part of this talk. You know, there's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, and the Mishnah tells us about Noisei Ba'ol Chaveiroi. Noisei Ba'ol Chaveiroi means that each one of us is obligated to bear the burden of our friend, to feel the pain of our friend. And the Mishnah is in Avos, Perek Vav, Mishnah Gimel, and it tells us 4 different ways how you can feel the pain and share in the pain of other people. One is betirchas aguf. Tirchas aguf means to help somebody physically. Now, for example, somebody's has a flat tire, right? And you go and you help him, and you go out of your way to help him, and physically, you've done a favor. Now, I'm going to tell you about 2 people that are here that you will not see on the video. See, it's very difficult to make a video if you got nobody here, right? I know that this video is going to 100,000 people. So I called somebody here in my neighborhood in Kew Gardens, and that person came with their child, and they're sitting right here in the audience. Thursday night before Shabbos, they have to prepare for Shabbos, but they're here. Tirchas Aguf, they went and they did me a favor so that they can be an audience. That's feeling the pain of somebody else, and I thank them. They will remain anonymous. The second thing is Hoitzos Momoin. Somebody needs a loan, especially in today's times, difficult times, many people out of a job. Somebody needs a loan. You give them some money or you give some tzedakah, Hoitzos Momoin. You're spending some money for somebody else. That's the second way to feel the pain of somebody else. The third way is tzar nafshoi. Your soul should feel the pain. Many times, Rachmana Litzlana, we know so many people today that are sick, and you're not a doctor. Or let's say they need money, and you don't have that type of money. You're not a wealthy person. But you feel their pain. Tzar nafshoi. What do? You daven for them. That's also a way of neisei ba'oil chaveiroi. Now, all this is explained in the Tiferes Yisrael, Ois Kuf Gimel, note 103. But the fourth way, to me, is the most shocking. It's the most incredible. You would never think that this is part of Noisei Ba'ol Chaveiroi. Listen to what he says. He says, Hein kishechoser seichel l'chaveiroi. When your friend is missing intelligence, when he's missing that wisdom, binyonim zmanim and temporary things, oy nitzchiim, or eternal things, lo yochush melahatriach hasatzme liyotzai. Don't hesitate to help him, lelamdoi, to teach him, letoivosai, what's his benefit, ba'olam hazeh or ba'olam habo, in this world and in the next world. In other words, if somebody does not know about Yiddishkeit, he doesn't have that wisdom, he doesn't have that intelligence, and he's pained because of it. His soul is in pain. And you go and you teach that person. You are makar of that person. That is noisei ba'ol chaveiroi. That's what Kirov is all about. Feeling the spiritual pain of people that feel so empty and people that are looking for more. So we have discussed the idea of passive Kirov. What's the essence of Kirov? I'll tell you something absolutely remarkable. You know, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, in his wonderful Sefer Emes LeYaakov, in Bereishis Chof Tes, Pasuk Dalet, Hey and Vov, tells us something absolutely remarkable. He tells us that Yaakov went out and he sees the shepherds and he says to them, Me'ayinatem, where are you from? He says, Achai, my brothers, Me'ayinatem, where are you from? And they say, we're from Haran. And he says to them, do you know Lavan? Yeah, they say, yeah, we know him. And he says, is Lavan doing okay? Yeah, they say, Lavan is doing fine. And then here comes Rachel. Rachel was obviously Lavan's daughter. And that's how Yaakov got to meet Rachel. Now, we find in the next pasuk, Yaakov is rebuking these shepherds. He just met them 5 minutes ago, right? He said to them, my brothers, how you guys doing? You know Lavan? Yeah, everything's fine. That's great. Now, listen to what he says. Hein oid hayoim godol. The day is great. Lo yeis ha'osif ha'michna. It's not time to gather in the flock yet. Hashku atzoinu l'chuleru. Give them some water. Graze with them. How did Yaakov feel that he could rebuke them? He doesn't even know them. He just came on the scene, and he's already telling them what to do? And the answer is, Rabbi Yaakov says, look how he started. He said, Achai, my brothers. He showed that he loved them. He showed that he validated their existence. When you show somebody that you love them, then they're ready to accept information from you. They can even accept rebuke. The essence of Kirov is Achai, my brothers. If you really love your fellow Jew, and it makes no difference to you, whether they're religious or not religious, you care about them, and you want to try to bring them to that level where you think they should be at, but they feel that you really love them, then when you invite them for a meal, whether you email something to them, or you send them a gift, but they know that it's with love and with compassion, then you're going to be able to be influential. That's the essence of Kirov. Achai, my brothers. And if that's the case, that's how we come now to the second part of Kirov, which is active Kirov. And I want to tell you something. I think that one of the best secrets, and unfortunately it is a secret, because I think that many people do not realize the broad scope of what Ura does. Ura is such a broad, all-encompassing, multifaceted, dedicated organization that is so totally involved in every aspect of Kirov that it is absolutely incredible. To me, it is one of the most incredible organizations involved in Kirov, and I want to show you why. You see, the primary goal of active Kirov is getting children in yeshivas. Over the years, Ura has brought thousands of young boys and young girls into yeshivas. Where do they get these kids from? You know where they get them from? They start with camp. There's a camp that's called Boy Zone and a camp that's called Girl Zone. They have these camps. There are 250 boys in the camp and 250 girls in the camp. And when these kids are in this camp, today I spoke to the one, Rabbi Elisha Lewinstein, who was interviewing counselors. And he told me that part of the interview and part of the commitment that a counselor has to make when he comes to the Ura camp is not only that he's going to take care and make a wonderful atmosphere for the kids in camp, but rather what they are going to do is, in addition, they're going to follow up throughout the winter. And every counselor is given one or two or three children that they have to call every single week to follow it up. And so therefore what happens is eventually they're able to bring these kids to yeshiva. And when they bring them to yeshiva, then all of a sudden the kids have a wonderful education from when they're young. They become Shemesh Shabbos when they're young. And they are given the tools and they are given the capabilities so that they can fight off the secular world and the immoral world and everything that is going on in public school. And not only that, when they have these camps and they have the kids already beginning to go to yeshiva, not everybody can they get to go to yeshiva, but when they follow up, then they begin talking to the parents and they start a program which is called Torah Mates. Torah Mates means people are learning together. And when people are learning together, especially the parents of these children are learning with other frum people, then all of a sudden the parents can help the kids in the homework. They can help them in the yeshivas. You know what's incredible? There is such an astronomical budget that Ura has for these children that they bring to school. They are paying today, this year, $130,000 a month they give out to schools, over 100 schools throughout the country. I recently had the opportunity to speak to a woman. Her name is Shira Haas. Shiraz Haas, an Israeli woman. She was not religious in Israel. Somehow she felt in Israel she doesn't have to be religious. She's Jewish. Everybody in Israel is Jewish. But then she came to a place called Elizabethtown, Pennsylvania, which is near Lancaster. And she had a little girl, and she wanted to have some Jewish education, but the school was 30 minutes away each way, back and forth. 30 minutes one way, 30 minutes the other way. And so she spoke to a Rabbi Sackett in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And he got her involved in Ura. Not only did Ura find her a school in that area, but Ura helped her pay the tuition. And not only that, she told me that Ura helped pay the gas for her every day that she should be able to bring her child. That's incredible. Not only to pay the gas, to pay the tuition, part of the tuition, but then they continue by sending packages, a Yontif package, a package on Hanukkah, a package on Purim, Shalach Monas. They send the sukkah. They've sent over 1,000 sukkahs to people all over the country so that people should be able to celebrate the Yontif properly. And you know, when I spoke to this woman today, she told me that she felt so encouraged every single time she spoke to the people at Ura. The Derech Eretz, she says, was stunning. They were so committed to her with her child, and now the little boy that was born afterwards, that she recently koshered her kitchen. Again, this all starts because of the wonderful yeshiva program. Now, here in Queens, where I live, there are 25 boys in Rabbi Keshani's school, in the Or HaChaim school, 15 boys and girls in the Ezra school. Ateres Yisrael, Rabbi Young Rice's school, has 40 children that Ura helps support. The Nefesh Academy, the Sinai Academy, the Maimonides Academy in Fort Lauderdale, the Hebrew Academy in Miami, the Maimonides Academy in Los Angeles, the Pollard's Day School in Cherry Hill, and the Torah Preparatory School in St. Louis, Yeshiva of Greater Washington, Silver Spring, Beis Shendel in Lakewood, and two places in Yerushalayim, Kesher Institute and Mechlelet Esther. That's only 15 out of 100. It's incredible. And if we support a wonderful organization like this, What we're doing is making sure that thousands of children that would never have the opportunity to go to Yeshiva Beis Yaakov or any type of religious day school, they would never go. Only if we support URA can they continue to doing their tremendous work. You know, there's another woman who I spoke to, and she told me that she once saw an ad for a Chol HaMoed trip that URA was going to take. URA was offering a free trip, one day Chol HaMoed for boys, they were going to go to New Rock City, and another place they were going to go with the girls, they were going to go to Great Adventure. She was so taken by this ad and the fact that the kids wouldn't have to pay for it, but at the end she didn't send her son. But she found out about the camp, Boy Zone, and she sent her son to camp. Not a religious woman at all. And she tells me that Rabbi Korngold, he brought out to her the great love of Torah that this boy has. And he said, this boy belongs in a yeshiva. He went to one yeshiva and it wasn't enough for him. Today, this boy is in Darkei Torah. How did it start? It started because of the ads of the Chol HaMoed trips that URA takes with all these children. It starts because of the Boy Zone, because of the wonderful time that these kids have in camp. You have to see how happy these kids are, the trips that they take, the davening that they have, the learning programs, the atmosphere, and the counselors who care. And not only that, the counselors who follow up with them. That's what it's all about. That's what we said in the beginning. Mi yale b'har Hashem u'mi yokum b'mkoyim kodshoy. It's not enough just to bring somebody to the top of the mountain. They have to be able to stay on top of the mountain. And the only way they can stay on top of the mountain is when the counselor or the mentor is continuing and following up with these children. I'll tell you something else. In 2 or 3 days from the day that I am making this video, there's a Shabbaton. That's another aspect of URA's Kiruv. The Shabbaton, they have 3 different types of Shabbatons. They have a family Shabbaton, which will be this coming weekend. 500 people will be at that Shabbaton. And at every table, there will be frum people and non-frum people. And the frum people are there for a purpose, to be able to inspire those people that are at the table. Then they have a separate Shabbaton for boys and a separate Shabbaton for girls. All this costs money. All this is bringing back these children to their heritage, to their Torah heritage. That's why it's so important to support this great organization. And do you know, of course I didn't know this, but it's important that we should all know. Not only do they have Boy Zone and Girl Zone for the summers, where, as I said, they have 250 kids in each camp, but they have what's called the Shabbat Zone in Flatbush, the first Shabbos in every month and the last Shabbos in every month. Any girl can go to what's called a Shabbat Zone. There's a home in Flatbush. Last week they had 40 girls that were there. Again, these girls that would have no opportunity to see what a Shabbos is all about. But that's what active Kira is all about. And that's what makes URA so special. To give these kids an opportunity to see what Shabbos is all about, they would have no idea. Certainly they wouldn't see it in their own homes. They see it in the camp, they follow it up, Shabbat zone at the Shabbatons, and eventually they're able to get them into schools, in yeshivas and Beis Yaakovs. And when they get them into yeshivas and Beis Yaakovs, then they're learning with their parents. And then they start what's an incredible thing, which is the holiday packages. As we said, they send them sukkahs, they send sukkahs to all over the country. They sent this past year over 2,000 menorahs, 2,000 packages on Purim, matzahs, it's incredible. All these things, that's the four-pronged message and method that URA undertakes. It's the yeshiva program, it's the family program, it's the camp program, and it's the package program. That's what it's all about. That's why, in my humble opinion, URA is one of the most special Kiruv organizations. Because as we said, each one of us has to be involved in Kiruv. Eich ele el ovi v'hanar einenu iti. How are we going to go to Shemayim? And the children, the Klal Yisrael, the children are not with us. So you have to be an active person in Kiruv. You have to show and try to inspire. But if you can't do it, the least that we can do is support a wonderful organization like URA. I just want to end with this magnificent story. See, standing behind this video camera is one of my close friends. His name is Benny Marvin. Benny and I have had the opportunity to travel literally throughout the world, seeing different cities. We traveled to Lithuania, we traveled to Frankfurt, and we traveled to Poland. But one year, Eli Slamowitz, who runs these tours, told me that he wanted that we should go to Budapest. We had never been to Budapest before. I'd never been to Hungary. And He said that we would be there for a day, we would go to certain museums and to certain synagogues. When we announced that we would be going to Hungary and Budapest, and that was going to be the last day of the trip, I have a mechutan, a fellow by the name of Alex Kramer. His son Hananya married my daughter Fegi. Alex calls me up from Los Angeles, and he says to me, you know, I would like to meet you in Budapest on the last day of your trip. And I said, Alex, you're going to schlep all the way from Los Angeles to come just to be a day with us on this trip? He said, it's worth it for me because I was born in Budapest. I want to go back and see where I was born. I want to see my hometown. And also, I would like to see some of the relatives. I haven't seen them in many, many years. Fine, we go through the whole trip. The last day of the trip, we come into this hotel, and sure enough, Alex and Shana Kramer are there waiting for us. We sit down to eat dinner, and Alex and I begin talking. Now, some of you who know about these trips that I've taken, I do a tremendous, tremendous amount of research before I go on this trip. And I went to a fellow, Avram Schoenberger, in Borough Park in Brooklyn, and he told me what went on along the Danube River. You see, the Danube River, Nebuch, in the early 1940s, the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, they would line up Jews along the Danube River, and they shot them into the water, and that's where they died. And not only that, I read afterwards that sometimes they would take three Jews and tie them together and only shoot the middle one, and the middle one would fall into the water being propelled there because of the bullet, and he would drag the other two on the other side of him, and they would drown to death. Except that there was a fellow, Raoul Wallenberg, who was a Swedish diplomat, and he hired divers on the other side of the river, and they would dive in and they would swim to where those two people who were still breathing, and they would cut the cords and they would save these people who were not actually shot, and they saved many, many Jews that way. So I knew that I was going to take everybody to the Danube River, because to me that was like a concentration camp. That's a place where Jews died only because that they were Jews. And so therefore I decided that I am going to take people, and we are going to daven there. Fine, we're sitting and talking at dinner, and Alice Kramer says to me, says, do you know anything that happened along the Danube River? I said, of course. And I told him everything I just told you, and I said, you know, tomorrow I'm planning to go there, and we want to daven there. We're all going to take our tilums, and we're going to pray there. He says, well, I was there today. He says, you know, they made a memorial for the Jews that were killed there.